Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to the Vox Pop for this Medical Monday, October 10th. I'm Alan Chartok. Support for Medical Monday comes from Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York, custom exhibits, interactive media displays, and commercial casework for corporate interiors, museum installations, and trade shows. EmpireExhibits.com. Joining us today is the wonderful, I love her, Dr. Nina Sachs of Albany, gastroenterology consultant. She's here to respond to your questions and comments on all things involving the gastrointestinal tract and ailments involving those parts of the body. It's going to be a busy hour, so be sure to get in now. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Nobody better in the business than Nina Sachs. Hello, everybody, once again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Our wonderful Dr. Nina Sachs, formerly of the Health Show, joins us today to respond to your questions and comments on gastroenterology. She comes to us from Albany, gastroenterology consultants in Albany. Dr. Sachs received her medical degree from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and completed her internal medicine internship and residency at Strong Memorial Hospital. Dr. Sachs completed her gastroenterology fellowship at Albany Medical College, is a board member of St. Peter's Surgery and Endoscopy Center. Dr. Nina Sachs, old, wonderful friend, thanks for being with us.
Alan, I'm not that old.
No, I didn't mean it that way.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
I didn't mean it that way. I meant we've been friends for a long time.
Oh, yes.
To give us a conversation, to give us your views or to ask your question, today's conversation, give us a call at 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Nina, what's hot? What's not?
Well, colonoscopy is always hot. Colon cancer screening is important. Hepatitis C treatment has been revolutionized.
What are we doing for that?
We're curing hepatitis C.
Really?
We are curing hepatitis C with oral medications. It's unbelievable in my lifetime to see that. The only problem is the medicines are so expensive.
But how expensive?
Extremely expensive. $120,000 for a 12-week course to cure hepatitis C.
So what happens if you don't have $120,000?
Well, so it was difficult at the beginning, but in New York State, it's covered. It's a covered benefit, and most insurers and on our Medicaid now.
Yeah.
So that has changed. Every state is not like that, and there are more treatments coming out. Different drug companies. So hopefully there'll be some competitive cost reduction.
Fantastic. Okay, yeah. Are you ready, Nina?
Yes. Oh, sure.
Okay, we'll go to Darren. All right, Darren. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Just calling in reference to H. pylori and its diagnosis, its treatments, and the follow-up to ensure that the illness was eradicated.
You wanted me to just explain that bacteria?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, Helicobacter pylori is a bacteria that is found in some people in the stomach. Right. It is felt to be causal in terms of peptic ulcer disease. We used to think that peptic ulcer disease was caused by what we ate or drank, and really it's that revolutionized the treatment of peptic ulcer disease was the finding of this H. pylori, and if you eradicate it, curing peptic ulcer disease and preventing recurrence. It's also been implicated in some cases perhaps of gastric cancer.
Wow.
And also, there are some relationships between acid reflux disease and H. pylori as well. The eradication is There are several steps to it, several medications, including potent antacid medicines and antibiotics. There are several different regimens. There have been some resistance of H. pylori to some of the regimens we used to use, and that has changed. So we do like to document eradication. So first of all, diagnosis. The diagnosis sometimes is done at the time of endoscopy. If you see an ulcer, you biopsy the stomach for H. pylori. A lot of times we do it anyway for patients with dyspeptic symptoms. If
what
we're
does
doing
that mean, dyspeptic?
Dyspeptic, agita, not feeling well, yeah. Abdominal pain. So we'll biopsy for H. pylori, and we can look at that under the microscope. To document eradication, we used to have to do another endoscopy to rebiopsy, but now we can do stool DNA tests or stool testing for H. pylori antigen. We don't do the blood test. The blood test is not very good anymore, so we'll do the stool testing or breath testing or repeat biopsy.
Breath testing, no kidding.
Breath testing, yes. The same as we would test for lactose intolerance or sugar intolerance.
Wow. Well, Dan, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I was not aware of the stool testing, and I have not been. I was diagnosed with H. pylori. I did take the antibiotic and the antacid regimen. However, my primary care did not follow up with the documentation of eradication.
Yes, and be careful. You know, when you do the stool testing, you need to be off of the potent antacid medications for 2 weeks before. Okay, those medicines do suppress the H. pylori bacteria.
Okay,
and that can be done at any point. You could do it a few months from now. You know,
Darren, thank you very much. Lines are filling up, but there's room for you. Let's go to Marie. All right, Marie in Poughkeepsie. Go ahead, Marie.
Hi there. I am 50 years old, and this is the second, and I'm healthy. I'm predominantly vegan. I exercise regularly. And this is the second year now that I'm experiencing fecal incontinence, which is not something you want to be doing when you're 50. I did go to the St. Peter's Clinic up in Albany to get some testing of the colon and area, and it was determined that I had, quote-unquote, altered nerve function. But my GI in Poughkeepsie, this is kind of beyond his scope, and he's at a bit of a loss. The St. Peter's Clinic had said, maybe you should go see a physical therapist that specializes in pelvic floor. And I'm just, nobody can kind of do anything to figure out why all of a sudden for the last 2 years I've been experiencing this. There's been no trauma.
Hold on a second, Marie.
Yeah, let me just ask a couple things. Have you had pregnancies and deliveries?
No, never.
Okay. You know, sometimes... you know, fecal incontinence or pelvic, what we call pelvic floor muscle dysfunction, can come. And the timing is 50 or a little older for women. I don't know what your body type is, if you're overweight or not overweight. It sounds like you said you're a very healthy person. If you've had a colonoscopy to make sure that there's no structural problem, if you've had... Have you had defecography, where you defecate and an MRI scan is done to look at the musculature of the pelvic floor?
No.
Okay. There are even in Albany, there are places where you can go and people you can see to have pelvic floor studies done.
What's the word floor mean?
Pelvic floor means the muscles down in the pelvis, and they kind of form, they kind of come together and form a floor for your pelvic organs. So that's what we call it. And there are pelvic floor physical therapists that can help with some of these symptoms, but it doesn't sound like you've had the full workup. You know, the workup
that
you're missing some of the, you're missing some of the imaging tests that you could do, and also some of the therapies. So what I would say is if your gastroenterologist where you live does not feel that he can do that, then I would see someone either down in the city or someone upstate where we are.
Marie, thank you. All right, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay. Jim, you're on. Go ahead.
Could you comment on the use of Reglan or Regulin and some of its side effects?
Yeah, Reglan, or the generic name is metoclopramide, is a medication that helps the stomach empty. So sometimes people with certain diseases can develop nausea, vomiting, and not because they have an ulcer or a blockage in the stomach, but because the stomach doesn't work properly, doesn't take that food and help it empty into the small bowel. One of the most common diseases where this is found is diabetes, because of the nerve ending damage to the nervous system that controls what we call motility or motion of the bowel. So metoclopramide has been used, taken before meals and at bedtime. It's a tough drug. You know, we don't really have excellent treatment at this time for what we call gastroparesis. Paresis means paralysis, so stomach paralysis. Reglan or metoclopramide is okay. It is effective for some people, but it can cause nightmares, jittery sensation. You really don't want to use it long term. And some of the other medicines we have used in the past have been taken off of the market because of heart issues and others. So they're still working on good medications for gastroparesis.
Thanks, Jim. And Nina, how? I mean, I think this is something everybody's probably thinking but not asking. How often should people be moving their bowels?
Oh, well, gastroparesis would be stomach. So I would say if we're talking about bowel habits, it depends on the person. So constipation, you don't have constipation just because you don't move your bowels every day. Some people, their normal bowel habits are to move their bowels once a week. Some people, three times a day. It depends. So if someone's moving their bowels once a week, but they're uncomfortable, bloated, then that's a problem. But for some, that's a normal pattern. So we look for changes in our usual pattern.
Okay, we're going to take a break. Thank you, Nina. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Curtis Lumber, specializing in deck and dock design, featuring Trex composite decking and railings, pressure-treated wood, and more. Design consultation available, CurtisLumber.com. The Brattleboro Retreat, providing hospital-based mental health services, including medically assisted alcohol withdrawal. BrattleboroRetreat.org for more information. And from Saratoga Hospital, welcoming Dr. Romel Gobunsoy to Saratoga Hospital Medical Group's Pulmonary and Sleep Medicine Practice at West Avenue in Saratoga Springs. SaratogaHospital.org for details.
We are back with the wonderful Dr. Nina Sachs, and she's here to answer your questions and comments on gastroenterology. And I got to tell you, there are two people on the phone, now three. If you want to talk, now's the time, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Lou in Altamont. All right, Lou in Altamont, you're on.
Dr. Sachs, have the gastroenterologists come to a final decision regarding diverticuli, whether it's affected by diet, specifically corn, seeds, nuts, popcorn, that type of food?
So, when I was a fellow and starting in practice, we used to tell our patients who have had diverticulitis, okay, so inflammation of diverticuli. So diverticuli, many of us have them. They're little outpouchings in the colon, okay? Because the colon has three muscles that run longitudinally. So in between those muscles, you can get little outpouchings. So while many of us have diverticuli, only a few of us get inflammation of the diverticuli or diverticulitis, which causes pain, fever, can go on to cause a perforation of the bowel, a hole in the bowel, and all kinds of abscess and problems. So what you're asking me, I believe, is if you've had diverticulitis, if you stop eating seeds, nuts, and popcorn, is that going to prevent you from having another attack or a problem? And I can tell you, we used to think that the answer was yes, and I'm coming to the point that the answer is no. There was a large study done, presented in Gut, which is the British Medical Journal, in 2009. They did thousands of case histories, and patients who've had diverticulitis followed them in different diets, and diet has played absolutely no role in terms of preventing future attacks of diverticulitis. It is important when you have acute diverticulitis, you're taking antibiotics, that you do back off on the fiber in the diet and you follow a low residue diet for a month or even two, but then gradually re-add fiber to the diet. So there is nothing about diet in terms of preventing future attacks.
And what's the difference between itis and osis?
Osis means you have the pouches.
Yes.
And itis means you've had attacks of inflammation and illness from them.
Yeah. Lou, anything else on this?
No, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lou. All right. Let's go now to none other than, Richard in Queensbury, where everybody plays by the rules. Richard, you're on.
Hi. I had a question about leaky gut syndrome. Is there any advances in treatments that have been developed recently to cure that, if you know anything about it?
What type of leaky gut syndrome? You know, protein
I don't know.
Enteropathy or what? That's a large, that's a big question.
So, Nina, why don't you tell us a little bit about what leaky gut, what kinds of leaky guts?
Sometimes patients can lose protein, have chronic diarrhea. Mm-hmm. They have certain deficiencies in their immune system that can lead to that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we do replace some of those immune cells. But I'm not quite sure. Can you tell me a little bit more about, is it something that you have or?
Well, I think I do. I haven't been diagnosed, but exposure to internal antibiotics, oral or injected antibiotics, has caused bad after effects over the years. And
so do you have diarrhea? Is that what you're saying? Or
sometimes. But the main thing is allergies, basically largely food allergies. And I'm pretty sure it's due to that. It's had some strong effects on my life.
Yeah, some of the elimination diets can be helpful for that. I don't really believe there's anything really new to tell you, but it sounds like you may need a little bit more workup to kind of figure out which foods may be the problem. And sometimes
They come and go. They come and go. Yeah. My immune system varies from the frequency of exposure to what I'm eating. There was a March 2015 Scientific American article extracted from Nature magazine, and they talk about the microbiome.
Well, of course, that's our new organ. That's the next organ of study.
Yeah,
yeah.
Major part of our life.
The microbiome. So the billions of bacteria that are unique to each of us, and you're really it's interesting to me. I read that article as well, and that is the next frontier in terms of research. There's no question, in terms of how to manipulate the microbiome, replace what you don't have with bacteria. It's implicated in obesity management, all types of immune illnesses such as ulcerative colitis, rheumatoid arthritis, how we take antibiotics as a child and how that could affect our ability to metabolize drugs or changes in our diet.
So would you say to Richard that he should get further checked out?
Well, it sounds like you're interested in this, and there are there are certain diets and other studies that could be done. Perhaps you've had them done already. I don't know.
Not really.
Hey, Richard, we've got to let you go. A huge number of people behind you.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. Now we are going to go, to Susan in Schenectady. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Hi. Hi. My question is regarding outlet constipation. And I was wondering if the cause of that is always the pelvic floor muscles, and if so, If you could speak on that and the effectiveness or lack of effectiveness of physical therapy for a woman in her 60s.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you should call now. You kind of have the opposite problem of the caller before, in that sometimes the pelvic floor muscles are spastic or they don't relax properly when you need to move your bowels. And for that type of issue, and I'm assuming you've been worked up for any mechanical problems, a mass in the colon, something in the pelvis. So once you've had that workup and it's felt that this is a pelvic floor muscle dysfunction or spasm of those muscles, then pelvic floor physical therapy can be very, very useful and effective.
And what specifically do you look for in a good physical therapist who treats that?
Yeah.
I ran into one that was not very good, in my opinion.
Where are you located?
I'm like Schenectady Colony area.
Yeah. You know, I don't have names with me now, but I have, I do have some good people to recommend. There is a pelvic health center at St. Peter's. Actually, it's at Memorial Hospital, but it's part of St. Peter's Partners. They do very good work. But there's other independent physical therapists as well. And just like with any other specialty, you may have to try one or two before you find someone who you kind of work with.
Yeah. Susan, if I emailed, would you be able to give me any names?
I probably could, yes.
Okay, so
if you email the station and
Email the station, we'll get it.
Yeah.
Email me.
Thank you so much.
Alan@WMC.org.
Yeah, I'll get something to him.
Thank you very much.
Okay. My name is actually slightly different because I have an unusual name that starts with R, I don't use it on the air.
You'll tell me, R, what you that you spoke to us on Medical Monday, okay? Thank you very
much. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll go to Hedvig in Hudson. Welcome back, Hedvig. You're on.
Oh, hiya. How are you today?
We're good.
Good, good. I just wanted to ask the doctor a question about the, I guess you call it transit time issue, how long it takes, you know, how often a person bowels move and so forth. So, I was under the impression that it wasn't a good thing. Like the longer the food stayed in the intestine, the more you were going to be absorbing products, you know, like the products of the decomposition and bacterium might be on the toxic side. So this is what I thought. But I just wonder what the doctor says, because she didn't seem to feel that there was any onus to having a longer transit time.
Yeah, there is a school of thought. There's a lot of there are people out there who believe in colon cleansing and taking enemas to clean out the stool, and to be honest with you, I really don't subscribe to that. I believe that everyone has a transit time. That transit time could be you know, people can move their bowels two or three times a day normally. Mm-hmm. They can move their bowels once a week normally. I think when it becomes an issue is when the person has symptoms, so is uncomfortable, bloated, has abdominal pain, hard stools, fissures, you know. So if that's the issue, then we can make some changes. I usually have my patients start with dietary changes, increasing their dietary fiber and fluid intake. And there are medications and supplements that can help that as well.
Sure. But, just so there's nothing going on in the way of the contents becoming a source of toxins.
No, that doesn't. That really has not been found in, you know, in research. I think that you know, you don't want to move your bowels once a month. That's unusual. Okay, so as long as you're in that several times a day to once a week kind of category and comfortable, and that's your usual pattern. What I become alarmed about is when the pattern changes. So someone who's moved their bowels every day suddenly isn't. And then you have to start to think about what's going on. And also if you're having rectal bleeding or other issues. So the time itself, you know, may be your, you know, how your body works.
But in the old days, there were an awful lot of people who had enemas all the time. We don't see that much
anymore. We don't see that. We don't see castor oil. I don't like enemas because I believe they really disrupt your pelvic floor muscles.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've been talking a lot about pelvic floor today for some reason. So
right.
Yeah. And
so
I don't
there's no like preservative action going on in there.
I don't
by some kind
no,
of chemical,
you eat
nothing,
a,
or
no, eat a healthy diet and let your bowels do what they're gonna do.
Okay,
I would not worry about that.
Hedvig, gotta let you go. Thank you. All right, let's go to Fred in Hurley, where ironically everybody keeps it down. Fred and Hurley, you're on.
Hi, folks. Good afternoon. Uh-huh. I have a mid-60s lady friend who has a condition, I believe they call it paracentesis. And so her abdomen is constantly filling up with fluid, and she can't release to the point where she had a herniated belly button, which had to be surgically corrected. And she has to go in for drainings every, 2 weeks now. And she's been through two gastroenterologists, and she's had numerous testings, and nobody seems to be able to comprehend why it's happening or how to correct it.
Where are you folks located?
We're in Kingston area.
Usually what you're talking about is not the paracentesis is the drainage process, you know, the procedure that you go through. What you're talking about is ascites. And that's
ascites. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's fluid abdomen. That can come from a variety of causes. It could be liver disease. It could be a vascular disease of the vessels in the abdomen. It could be a tumor, but it doesn't sound like if something that's been chronic, that tumor, I assume, has been ruled out, female cancers.
But I think the liver might be the issue.
Yeah,
primarily.
Usually it is cirrhosis of the liver. So there's backup of fluids and humors into the abdominal cavity and then leakage because the drainage is backed up and then leakage of fluid into the abdomen. And the treatment is diuretics or medicines to help get rid of the fluid and also, as you're describing, what's called therapeutic paracentesis. But typically that's liver disease, typically.
Is that a shunt thing also? Can that be done?
Well, you know, it really depends, on the reason for the for the liver disease. There are shunts that can be done, but sometimes the side effects of those are quite severe. So the therapeutic paracentesis may be the best approach, but that's a complex issue, too complex for the telephone.
Okay, Fred, thank you for calling.
Very good.
Appreciate it. All right. That was a very interesting answer, Dr. Nina Sachs. Let's go to Susan in Altamont. All right, Susan in Altamont, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Dr. Sachs.
Hey.
I heard what you said to Lou about diverticulitis, diverticulosis.
Yeah.
And I wanted to just elaborate a little bit more about that. I've had 8 bouts of diverticulitis, and one of your colleagues has been my doctor for a long, long time. He has now referred me to a gastroenterologist surgeon who has now got me on a very low-residue diet.
Mm-hmm.
But I am terrified of eating seeds, nuts, popcorn, corn of any kind, because out of the 8 bouts of diverticulitis, I had 6 bouts after I ate the seeds, popcorn, or nuts or stuff like that. And what you said to Lou is that now you're thinking, the doctors are thinking, it's okay to have this sort of thing, but I'm absolutely terrified to try and do it again.
Yes, so here you have to listen to the patient, okay? So I'm answering a question, a general question about diet and diverticulitis. And now I'm talking to you with your history, okay? And you're telling me, Doc, every time I eat seeds, I develop diverticulitis. I listen to that carefully, okay? And so I would modify the diet accordingly. Also, it may be that for you, you're not healing completely in between. It sounds like you've had recurrent episodes. So for you, it may be that the inflammation that develops around the diverticuli is not resolving. And so no matter what you eat, that reoccurs. There's also some interesting studies being done now that recurrent diverticulitis. That's a different issue. You know, you have rapid recurrence of diverticulitis, may actually represent inflammatory bowel disease or a variant of colitis.
I do have that.
Yeah, so that
as
the,
well.
So that the colitis, it's called peridiverticular colitis, and that develops. And so that may be why your situation is different from perhaps the average person who develops one episode, gets better, and never has another. So I always listen to the patient. Patient tells me, Doc, every time I eat raspberries, I have diverticulitis. I say, you know what? The literature says this.
Don't scratch.
But I listen to my patients, and I would tell
them. In other words, I should avoid.
I would avoid them, especially now. And you may, you know, at some point you might require surgery for this problem.
Well, they're trying not to. He knows. He's been monitoring me for about a year now, and he's trying to avoid the surgery.
Absolutely, and we're doing less and less surgery for diverticulitis. It sounds like you're doing the right things, and I would not tell you to eat foods that precipitate your problem. Absolutely, I agree with you.
Susan, thank you.
Could I ask one more question, Alan, about celiac?
Okay.
I was treated for celiac up to I was 16 years old. And then my doctor, who's your colleague, told me I never had it. So is there a disease that mimics celiac that I was treated for all these years?
Celiac is a fascinating topic. Gluten, wheat protein. Celiac disease can be diagnosed easily now, okay, much more easily perhaps than when you were 16. But gluten intolerance, there's another entity called gluten intolerance. So you don't have actual celiac disease, but when you eat wheat-containing foods or grains, you develop bloating, abdominal pain, diarrhea, and that's a different entity than celiac. So it's hard for me to say because I didn't know you at 16, but...
No, I had it in the 40s and 50s, up to 16. I had it from a child up to 16.
It may very well be that if the doctor does not feel you have celiac, that you have gluten intolerance. And again, that's treated with a gluten-free diet.
Yeah. Listen, Susan, I'm so sorry. We've got to let you go because we're up against the break, okay?
I get it, Alan. Thank you so very much, and thank you, Dr. Sachs.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right, Zach, take it away.
Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology, now offering amyloid PET imaging for brain scans to help evaluate Alzheimer's disease and causes of cognitive decline. NewYorkOncology.com. Albany Cardiothoracic Surgeons, providing patient-centered heart surgery for over 40 years in the Capital Region, practicing cardiac surgery at St. Peter's Hospital, ACTSURG.com. Sage Wine and Spirits, Ballston Spa, New York, providing worldwide sustainable and organic wines and spirits, offering weekly tastings, sagewinespirits.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, and Thai entrees. Daily specials, delivery expanding to Gilderland, 518-432-0358. And from Maria College, Albany, bachelor's and associate degrees in health sciences, nursing, liberal arts, and management. Day, evening, and weekend programs. Open house this Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. NewMariaCollege.com.
And we are back with the extraordinary Dr. Nina Sachs. Just love her and love having her here. And it's just great to see you again, Nina. Let's go to... I think we... Did I get rid of that? I don't know. Okay, let's try. Did we do Susan in Altamont? Did we just do that one? I don't know. All right, let's see. Okay, number four.
I think we did.
We did? No, yeah, we did. Okay, so hang that up. All right, now let's go to Lorraine in Windsor. Okay, Lorraine in Windsor, you're there, and we're here.
Yes.
Hello.
That's great. Thank you very much for taking my call. When I was 49, I came down with a severe case of diverticulitis from endometriosis when I was younger because everything stuck together. And I had a colon resection when I was 62. And I still have a little diverticulosis still in there. And once in a while, I get like bloating, and I get a very strange kind of skin reaction on my abdomen where it's not really a rash, but it's in reddened, inflamed tissue, like in on top of where it's distended. And I just was wondering if that was connected to diverticulitis, because it always seemed to be connected to me, but all the doctors always said, no, that's not, you know, possible.
You know what? That does not sound, and it's hard over the phone, but that does not sound like acute diverticulitis to me. But what it sounds like is sometimes when you have bloating, you might have a food intolerance. You know, we were talking about gluten intolerance and food intolerances.
Right.
And sometimes what happens is, particularly when you eat different kinds of sugars, and keep in mind, sugar is not just table sugar. It's fruit. There's sugars in bread and all kinds of foods and pasta. And sometimes when we eat those, we may be intolerant to those sugars and we develop bloating. And you might even develop a small rash the way you're, you know. So that might be an explanation. I would, of course, make sure that you've seen your gynecologist, that, you know, if you still have ovaries, that those have been examined by your GYN. And, you know, so all these other things that can cause bloating. But sugar intolerances are a big problem. And there's a new diet, relatively new diet, that my patients have had some success with for chronic bloating, called the FODMAP diet, F-O-D-M-A-P. You can look that up online. And that is a gluten-free, lactose-free, low-sugar diet. And patients have really, it's not easy, but when you follow that, the bloating just about goes away completely. So you might think about that FODMAP diet.
Very interesting.
Okay,
very
okay, Lorraine, thank you very much. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Things are not exactly working the way I had hoped they would here, because some people are still showing who are on the thing and they're not really in it. Anyway, let's go to Joseph in South Hadley. Joseph, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Dr. Sachs and Dr. Alan Chartok. My question is simple. Is it a good idea to continue to take probiotics after you've first been given them to combat the effects of antibiotics once you stop the antibiotics, or is there any feeling one way or the other on that?
Well, that whole issue of probiotics, again, is fascinating. And, you know, if you were listening before, we were talking about the new organ system, the microbiome in the gut, the bacterial
gut. That's when
I
first tuned you in, and it reminded me of I had this question.
Yes, and so, you know, probiotics are now, people take them. I would say that they're useful, we say, to promote replacement of colonic bacteria and gut bacteria after they've been denuded by antibiotics. So you're right. You took them after the antibiotics, and that's fine. Now, whether to continue them, no one really knows the answer to that. I would say for my patients who have irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, they can be very helpful. For others who have bloat-predominant irritable bowel syndrome, they're terrible because they cause a lot of bloating.
How about the opposite of diarrhea?
If you are constipated, it's hard to say if they'll help. I don't think they will specifically help constipation.
I'll tell you, I had chemo, which ended after my cancer apparently is cured, but
wonderful.
Then I had a low blood count. I went into the hospital. I had an infection. I got the antibiotic, and then they gave me this. So I found it helped with my regularity, but maybe I'm deluding myself here.
Well, you know what? It's not going to hurt you, and if you think that it is helping, I think that's fine. As long as your immune function is normal, you know, you talk about chemo, just make sure if your counts are good and your oncologist says it's okay, I think it's fine to continue it. Even if you wanted to continue it every other day, or you wanted to add yogurt to the diet and some other natural probiotics.
My wife eats yogurt,
you know? So, you know, for some of us
yogurt
haters, you know, this is fine, but I would just make sure that, you know, your immune function is normal. So that's the only thing I would
say. Thank you very much. Thank you, doctor.
My pleasure.
And while we're playing with the system, Nina, let me ask you the question that many of us want to answer on a program of this kind. Well, it might be a little bit unpleasant And that is, what do you do about flatulence?
Oh, well, gas in the digestive tract. You know, that's a normal bodily function. I would say for some people, they feel full and bloated and too much gas with too many symptoms. And for them, Alan, we talked about that FODMAP diet. You know, it's really sugar malabsorption, malabsorption of sugars in the gut that leads to bloating and flatulence. So, again, those sugars, milk sugar, table sugar, bread is a long chain of sugar, really. So there is so much
ketchup I read the other
right,
day.
There's so much sugar in the diet, so that by taking some of that out, by avoiding, did you ever wonder why if you eat broccoli there's so much flatulence? Because that's really a high sugar vegetable.
Really?
So this FODMAP diet, FODMAP, that has really, even by looking at that and picking the low FODMAP of fruits and vegetables instead of the high FODMAP, it's going to make a difference. So a lot of my patients have been doing the FODMAP diet, at least a modification, for weeks or months, and it's been very helpful.
That's great. Okay, let's go to, if this works, to Ann in Glens Falls. Ann, you're on.
Hi. I have a question about, I had an endoscopy done a while ago, and I was diagnosed with diffuse pervasive stomach polyps, which the doctor said was a result of long-term use of a protein pump inhibitor. He said it was kind of a rare occurrence, but it does happen. So he switched me to something that wasn't a PPI. But my question is, he didn't really indicate that I needed any follow-up or anything.
Do you know what kind of polyps? Do you know what kind of polyps, what the pathology was of the polyps? Were they fundal gland polyps?
Yes.
Fundal gland.
They were.
All right. Mm-hmm. So we use these medications. It's an interesting topic, the proton pump inhibitors. All right. So just, I'll give you a few generics, omeprazole, Prevacid. Those medications have really, when they came out, it revolutionized treatment for peptic ulcer disease and acid reflux because they're such potent anti-acid medications. They just turn off acid production. So as a result, people were taking them, and they continue to take them. And there have been some things that have happened to people because they've taken them. Not that they're bad medications, but there is some literature suggesting that perhaps we shouldn't be taking them every day or for life. So one of those things is when you stop stomach acid, patients can get these polyps or these multiple, what they call polyps. And you're talking about fundal gland polyps, which are absolutely benign. Okay, if that's indeed what you have. There's other polyps, adenomatous polyps, and hyperplastic polyps. Those need to be monitored and watched and removed. But fundal gland polyps, they just kind of, they look like little clear polyps. They peel right off with a biopsy forceps. And some patients can get many, many of them when they're on these medicines. I hate to tell you, it's not that uncommon. I see it all the time. All right, so from a few to many. And there are some patients who have many, which it sounds like you do, that I would say, you know what, let's try to taper you off of the potent anti-acid medicine and see if you do well with a milder anti-acid medicine, such as Tagamet or Pepcid or Zantac. And but you know what, you should always be doing that. You should always be looking at the patient and saying, do you still need this medicine? And if you do, you should take the lowest possible dose of your omeprazole or PPI, as you said, to control your symptoms. But if you don't need the medicine, we should taper you off and use a less potent acid medication. Because, you know, you want to absorb your calcium, absorb your vitamins and minerals in your food. And there's been some implication perhaps with osteopenia and osteoporosis with long-term use of these medicines. And other things that have been alluded to, such as Alzheimer's disease and kidney function abnormalities that have not been proven in the literature. There's just a few poorly controlled studies. So I'm not as worried about that, but I always want my patients to be at the lowest possible dose of those medicines. And sometimes that's omeprazole 40 milligrams once a day. And they, you know, and you want to have them comfortable and be able to eat and function. For some, it may be every other day dosing. For some, it may be just taking the medicine when they have a symptom. Mm-hmm. So it could be
any of
those things.
And will the polyps ever... Will the polyps ever go away, or they just remain there? Or?
They may very well. If you were to have an endoscopy a year after being off of omeprazole or whichever one you were taking, it may be that you'll have a marked regression in those polyps. But unless you look, you're not really going to know.
Yeah, well, it's right. These are very popular medications, right?
They are. But I would tell you that the frontal gland polyps are very common.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right, thank you very much. All right. And now we are going to go to Carol in Enfield. All right. Carol in Enfield, you're on. Carol? Hello, Carol. All right. As we say to my grandson, one, two, three. Bye. Okay, now we're going to try to go to Cricket in Hudson. All right, Cricket, you're on.
Hello, Dr. Shartok and Dr.
Sachs.
Nina Sachs. I'm calling because I have both acid reflux and Crohn's disease. I've been on Entacort, 9 milligrams down to 3 for at least 12 years, and Nexium 80 milligrams down to 40 for the same amount of time. I want to know if there are any other options than taking the steroids.
The short answer is yes, but what type of Crohn's? Where is your Crohn's disease? Small bowel, large bowel, both?
Large bowel.
So you have Crohn's colitis?
Yes.
Okay. And you've been on, there are other medicines that are non-steroid based, like mesalamine medications, azacolaprizo, Lialda. Have you been on anything like that?
No, I've only been on the Entacort and the Nexium. That's it.
Okay, well, the Nexium, that's a different issue. That's for acid reflux.
Right.
You know, that, as we just talked about, being on the lowest possible dose to control your symptoms of that medication, which, and as far as Crohn's disease and Crohn's colitis, yes, there are other medications.
While we're on the subject, there is there's surgery, possible surgery, to correct hiatal hernia, for example, which would do away with a lot of people's. I've known gastroenterologists who say, I don't want you to do that. That's not a good idea.
Yeah, I think the surgery for acid reflux, there are surgeries. There are devices and techniques to increase the tone in the muscle between the esophagus and stomach, called the lower esophageal sphincter. Mm-hmm. I think you have to pick the patients for surgery or laparoscopic surgery or devices very carefully, because there can be potential risk to the surgery and also side effects thereafter. So
right.
If you have acid reflux symptoms that are easily controlled with medication, you may not want to refer that patient for surgery. If you have a patient who has severe reflux and complications of reflux and has failed a medical treatment, that may be a patient to consider. But you want to make sure that the motion, the quality of the motion, the motility in the esophagus is normal, that they're not someone who has bloating, because after reflux surgery, you could have what's called gas bloat syndrome, which can be crippling. So you just want to pick your patients carefully.
So, but there may be some damned if you do, damned if you don't. You just told us, I've been on this medication for years. The question then becomes, if it leads to some of these complications.
It may. I'd say we don't have any proof about some of them that I've talked about that have been alluded to in one article or two poorly crafted article. I think in terms of bone health and these medicines, we have many, many treatments and monitoring for our bone health. I think what I do with my patients is, for people who really need this medicine symptomatically, I put them on the lowest possible dose. So I don't tell my patients, listen, I'm putting you on omeprazole. You can go eat anything you want. You can drink anything you want. That's not what I want them to do. I want them to be careful with their diet and lifestyle, and then be on the lowest possible dose to control their symptoms.
So I find if I don't eat past 5 o'clock, very helpful.
Absolutely. So when I talk about anti-reflux measures, not eating late, not not eating close to bedtime, not lying down after meals, avoiding too much alcohol, caffeine. You know, caffeine's a biggie in our society.
Is it?
You know, really.
Yeah.
So not
does that include not decaf?
It does, because decaf has acid. It's really the acid.
Oh, boy.
Right?
One more thing I can do.
So, a little bit. But I'm saying, you know, if you're doing all those things, you want to keep your weight down. Weight is, a big issue with reflux.
It puts pressure.
It does. It's a mechanical pressure. So sleep apnea is related to reflux, and sleep apnea is related to obesity. So all these things are important.
Oh, boy. Anyway.
Do they connect at all with the Crohn's?
I don't, it doesn't sound in your case like there's a connection. I think they're two separate issues that need to be treated. But it sounds like you might want to talk to your doctor about alternatives to the steroid if he or she feels that would be appropriate.
Okay, got to let you go.
Well, I have sores on my skin all the time, and I've been told it's because of the steroid.
Yeah, so I would tell you to talk to your doctor a little bit more, because I think there are other things.
Got to let you go. All right, we are out of time. I want to thank all the people who called in and many who we left on the line, like Chad and Ann and Jennifer and Eileen and Carol. Nina, obviously, you'll have to come back. Thank you very much, all. We're just about out of time. Thanks to Dr. Nina Sachs for joining us. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to all of those people I just named. Support for Medical Monday comes from the Pride Center of the Capital Region, presenting the 2016 Pride Center Gala, honoring individuals, organizations, and businesses who support the LGBTQ community. November 4th at the Hilton Albany, capitalpridecenter.org. Thanks for joining us today on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer has been Ray Graff. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.